Welcome all to the Sharon Hour, me Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935. Tonight my topic is genius. What is genius really, and where does it come from? The writer Liz Gilbert, who wrote the phenomenally best-selling book Eat, Pray, Love, has the theory.
In ancient Greece and ancient Rome, people did not happen to believe that creativity came from human beings. People believed that creativity was this divine attendant spirit that came to human beings from some distant and unknowable source for distant and unknowable reasons. The Greeks famously called these divine attendant spirits of creativity daemons. Socrates famously believed that he had a daemon who spoke wisdom to him from afar. The Romans had the same idea, but they called that sort of disembodied creative spirit a genius, which is great because the Romans did not actually think that a genius was a particularly clever individual. They believed that a genius was this sort of magical divine entity who was believed to literally live in the walls of an artist's studio, kind of like Dobby, the house elf, and who would come out and sort of invisibly assist the artist with their work and would shape the outcome of that work. Everyone knew that this is how it functioned. So the ancient artist was protected from certain things like, for example, too much narcissism, right? If your work was brilliant, couldn't take all the credit for it. Everybody knew you had this disembodied genius who had helped you. If your work bombed, not entirely your fault. Everyone knew your genius was kind of lame. And this is how people thought about creativity in the West for a really long time. And then the Renaissance came and everything changed and we had this big idea. And the big idea was, let's put the individual human being at the center of the universe, right? Above all gods and mysteries, and there's no more room for mystical creatures who take dictation from the divine. And it's the beginning of rational humanism. And people started to believe that creativity came completely from the self of the individual. And for the first time in history, you start to hear people referring to this or that artist as being a genius rather than having a genius. And I got to tell you, I think that was a huge error. I think that allowing somebody, one mere person, to believe that he or she is like the vessel, like the font and the essence and the source of all divine, creative, unknowable, eternal mystery is just a smidge too much responsibility to put on one fragile human psyche. It just completely warps and distorts egos, and it creates all these unmanageable expectations about performance. And I think the pressure of that has been killing off our artists for the last 500 years.
The writer Elizabeth Gilbert considers that it might be our salvation to go back to that idea of genius being something outside of us, a kind of spirit that invades us, for which we're just the receptacle. Genius is the topic of my KX935's The Sharon Hour tonight.
There's probably people who would raise really legitimate scientific suspicions about the notion of basically fairies who follow people around like rubbing fairy juice on their projects and stuff. Like, I'm not probably going to bring you all along with me on this. But the question that I kind of want to pose is, why not? Why not think about it this way? Because it makes as much sense as anything else I have ever heard in terms of explaining the utter maddening capriciousness of the creative process, a process which, as anybody who has ever tried to make something knows, does not always behave rationally. Is it rational? Is it logical that anybody should be expected to be afraid of the work that they feel they were put on this earth to do? And what is it specifically about creative ventures that seems to make us really nervous about each other's mental health in a way that other careers don't do? We writers have this reputation over the centuries for being alcoholic manic depressives. And not just writers, but creative people across all genres, it seems, have this reputation for being enormously mentally unstable. You know, all you have to do is look at the very grim death count in the 20th century alone of really magnificent creative minds who died young and often at their own hands. And even the ones who didn't literally commit suicide seemed to be really undone by their gifts. Norman Mailer, just before he died, last interview, he said, "Every one of my books has killed me a little more." An extraordinary statement to make about your life's work. But we don't even blink when we hear somebody say this because we've heard that kind of stuff for so long, and somehow we've completely internalized and accepted collectively this notion that creativity and suffering are somehow inherently linked, and that artistry in the end will always ultimately lead to anguish. You know, I'm not at all comfortable with that assumption. I think it's odious, and I also think it's dangerous, and I don't want to see it perpetuated. perpetuated into the next century. I think better if we encourage our great creative minds to live. And I definitely know that in my case, in my situation, it would be very dangerous for me to start sort of leaking down that dark path of assumption, particularly given the circumstance that I'm in right now in my career, which is I'm pretty young. I'm only about 40 years old. I still have maybe another 4 decades of work left in me. And it's exceedingly likely that anything I write from this point forward is going to be judged by the world as the work that came after the freakish success of my last book. I should just put it bluntly, it's exceedingly likely that my greatest success is behind me. That's the kind of thought that could lead a person to start drinking gin at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I don't want to go there. You know, I would prefer to keep doing this work that I love, and so the question becomes how? And so I've been trying to find other societies to see if they might have had better and saner ideas than we have about how to help creative people manage the inherent emotional risks of creativity.
You're listening to the writer Elizabeth Gilbert from her TED Talk, excerpted here on The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935. After the spectacular and largely unexpected success of her book Eat, Pray, Love, she found herself having to deal with the problem of sustaining a certain level of creative excellence for the next book. And it led her to explore the source of genius, whether this was something that came from within or arrived at you from without.
I had this encounter recently where I met the extraordinary American poet Ruth Stone, who's now in her 90s, but she's been a poet her entire life. And she told me that when she was growing up in rural Virginia, she would be out working in the fields, and she said she would feel and hear a poem coming at her from over the landscape. And she said it was like a thunderous train of air, and it would come barreling down at her over the landscape. And when she felt it coming, because it would like shake the earth under her feet, she knew that she had only one thing to do at that point, and that was to, in her words, run like hell. And she would run like hell to the house, and she'd be getting chased by this poem, and the whole deal was that she had to get to a piece of paper and a pencil fast enough so that when it thundered through her, she could collect it and grab it on the page. And other times she wouldn't be fast enough, so she'd be like running and running and running, and she wouldn't get to the house, and the poem would like barrel through her and she would miss it. And she said it would continue on across the landscape looking, as she put it, for another poet. And then there were these times, this is the piece I never forgot, she said that there were moments when she would almost miss it, right? So she's like running into the house and she's looking for the paper, and the poem passes through her and she grabs a pencil just as it's going through her. And then she said she would reach out with her other hand and she would catch it. She would catch the poem by its tail, and she would pull it backwards into her body as she was transcribing on the page. And in these instances, the poem would come up on the page perfect and intact, but backwards from the last word to the first. So when I heard that, I was like, that's uncanny. That's exactly what my creative process is like. It's not at all what my creative process. I'm not the pipeline, you know, like I'm a mule. And the way that I have to work is that I have to get up at the same time every day and sweat and labor and like barrel through it really awkwardly. But even I, in my mulishness, even I have brushed up against that thing at times. Even I have had work or ideas come through me from a source that I honestly cannot identify. And what is that thing? And how are we to relate to it in a way that will not make us lose our minds, but in fact might actually keep us sane? And for me, the best contemporary example that I have of how to do that is the musician Tom Waits, who I got to interview several years ago at a magazine assignment. And we were talking about this. And, you know, Tom, I mean, for most of his life, he was pretty much the embodiment of the tormented contemporary modern artist. But then he got older and he got calmer. And one day he was driving down the freeway in Los Angeles, he told me, and this is when it all changed for him. He's speeding along, and all of a sudden he hears this little fragment of melody that comes into his head, as inspiration often comes, elusive and tantalizing, and he wants it. You know, it's gorgeous, and he longs for it, but he has no way to get it. He doesn't have a piece of paper. He doesn't have a pencil. He doesn't have a tape recorder. So he starts to feel all that old anxiety start to rise in him, like, I'm going to lose this thing, and then I'm going to be haunted by this song forever, and I'm not good enough, and I can't do it. And instead of panicking, he just stopped that whole mental process, and he did something completely novel. He just looked up at the sky and he said, excuse me, can you not see that I'm driving? Do I look like I can write down a song right now? You know, if you really want to exist, come back at a more opportune moment when I can take care of you. Otherwise, go bother somebody else today. Go bother Leonard Cohen. And his whole work process changed after that. Not the work. The work was still like oftentimes as dark as ever. But the process and the heavy anxiety around it was released when he took the genie, the genius, out of him where it was causing nothing but trouble and released it kind of back where it came from and realized that this didn't have to be this internalized, tormented thing. It could be this peculiar, wondrous, bizarre collaboration, kind of conversation between Tom and the strange external thing that was not quite Tom.
The smart money's on Harlem, and the moon is in the street, and the shadow boys are breaking all the laws. And you're east of East St. Louis, and the wind is making speeches, and the rain sounds like a round of applause. And Napoleon is weeping in the carnival saloon. His invisible fiance's in the mirror, and the band is going home. It's raining hammers, it's raining nails. It's true, there's nothing left for him down here. And it's time, time, time. And it's time, time, time. And it's time, time, time that you love, and it's time, time, time. And they all pretend they're orphans, and their memory's like a train. You can see it getting smaller as it pulls away. And the things you can't remember tell the things you can't forget. The history puts a saint in every dream. She said she'd stick around until the bandages came off. But these mama's boys just don't know when to quit. And Matilda asked the sailors, all those dreams or all those prayers. So close your eyes, son, and this won't hurt a bit. Oh, it's time, time, time. And it's time. Time, time, time that you love. And it's time, time, time.
The super talented Tom Waits here on KX935's The Sharon Hour. Tom Waits provided a valuable story for Liz Gilbert when she was writing the book that was to prove a phenomenal success and a worldwide bestseller.
When I was in the middle of writing Eat, Pray, Love, and I fell into one of those pits of despair that we all fall into when we're working on something and it's not coming, and you start to think this is going to be a disaster, this is going to be the worst book ever written. Not just bad, but the worst book ever written. And I started to think I should just dump this project. But then I remembered Tom talking to the open air, and I tried it. I just lifted my face up from the manuscript, and I directed my comments to an empty corner of the room, and I said aloud, listen, you thing, you and I both know that if this book isn't brilliant, that is not entirely my fault, right? Because you can see that I am putting everything I have into this. I don't have any more than this. So if you want it to be better, then you got to show up and do your part of the deal, okay? But if you don't do that, you know what? The hell with it. I'm going to keep writing anyway because that's my job. And I would please like the record to reflect today that I showed up for my part of the job. Maybe a creative life doesn't have to be quite so full of anguish if you never happened to believe in the first place that the most extraordinary aspects of your being came from you. Maybe if you just believed that they were on loan to you from some unimaginable source for some exquisite portion of your life to be passed along. This is how I've started to think. And if we think about it this way, it starts to change everything. And what I have to keep telling myself is don't be afraid. Don't be daunted. Just do your job. Continue to show up for your piece of it, whatever that might be. If the divine cockeyed genius assigned to your case decides to let some sort of wonderment be glimpsed for just one moment through your efforts, then ole. And if not, ole to you nonetheless. I believe this and I feel like we must teach it. Ole to you nonetheless, just for having the sheer human love and stubbornness to keep showing up. We'll be right back.
Show flags up in the sky.
Us all then. Maybe if we build it, they will come. If we create the fertile ground, genie may head our way. Thing is, even if it's not some evanescent spirit floating around that happens to deposit its genius in you, it's hard for any single individual really to bear that nebulous title of genius, because there's always going to be someone or series of someones before you that have laid all the heavy groundwork. So, okay, it's hard to remove the ego from it, because it's kind of like doing a jigsaw puzzle where you're up into the wee hours of the morning building the frame and filling most of it in, and then your cousin comes down while you're asleep and completes it and takes all the credit. But that's very often how it works. My good friend Eric Lacks wrote a wonderful book titled The Mold in Dr. Florey's Coat, and it was about the discovery of penicillin. And Florey was certainly at the forefront of that, but he was the less flamboyant character than Alexander Fleming, who was very social and had also been involved in all the scientific research that led up to the ultimate discovery. And so he, in a way, made a better ambassador for the product. He certainly, in people's heads, got the ultimate credit. But as we've learnt from Liz Gilbert, what then? People have to go on living their lives, doing what they do. And you're always trying to top yourself. I mean, to do better, not to do yourself in. Which, unfortunately, as Elizabeth Gilbert reminded us, many creative talents do, from a surfeit of genius that they can't actually cope with. An awful lot is expected of you if you're given that accolade. So really, we should attribute it to the fairies and just go on about our business. As I suggested in last week's KX935's The Sharon Hour on the power of music, musical compositions often seem to arrive on fairy droppings, as it were, sometimes fully formed without much import from the actual composer. I cited the song Yesterday that Paul McCartney claims came to him in a dream.
I used to live in this little flat up at the top of a house, in a little room I had, and I had a piano by the bed. And I just woke up one morning with this tune in my head. And I thought, I don't know this tune, or do I? It's like an old jazz tune or something, and I've, because my dad used to know a lot of old jazz stuff. Well, maybe I've just remembered it or somewhere. So I sort of went to the piano, found the chords to it. You know, it was like in G, F sharp minor, 7, sort of B and that. And kind of just remembered it, made sure I remembered it. And then I just hawked it round to all my friends and stuff and said, what's this? You know, it's got to be something. It's like a good little tune, you know, and I couldn't have written it because I just dreamed it, you know. You don't get that lucky.
It wasn't until he got the lyric together that he decided to record it. And he said, how should we do it? I said, well, it's a lovely song, super song. I can't really see what Ringo can do on it. I can't really see what heavy electric guitars are going to do on it. Why didn't you just go down there and sing it to me with a guitar and we'd decide what to do with it then.
And it was good, actually, because all the others, the guys, I looked at them like, oops, I mean, you know, solo record. And they said, yeah, you know, it doesn't matter, but there's nothing we could add to it, so do it.
So he did, with ultimately a wonderful George Martin arrangement. George Martin was who you heard talking with him in the middle. And it went on to be a huge hit, recorded by many artists other than Paul, including, as you heard last week, Placido Domingo, of all people. You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Luna's KX935. My topic tonight is genius. So where does genius come from? Is it in you? Something you can narcissistically be proud of? Or, as Liz Gilbert modestly suggests and even hopes for, does it find you? It might, for instance, even find you at Starbucks.
The English Coffee House was crucial to the development and spread of one of the great intellectual flowerings of the last 500 years, what we now call the Enlightenment. And the coffee house played such a big role in the birth of the Enlightenment, in part because of what people were drinking there, right? Because before the spread of coffee and tea through British culture, what people drank, both elite and mass folks, drank day in and day out from dawn until dusk was alcohol, right? Alcohol was the daytime beverage of choice. You would drink a little beer with breakfast and have a little wine at lunch, a little gin, particularly around 1650, and top it off with a little beer and wine at the end of the day. That was the healthy choice, right? Because the water wasn't safe to drink. And so effectively, until the rise of the coffee house, you had an entire population that was effectively drunk all day. And you can imagine what that would be like in your own life if you were drinking all day, and then you switched from a depressant to a stimulant in your life, you would have better ideas. You would be sharper and more alert. And so it's not an accident that a great flowering of innovation happened as England switched to tea and coffee. But the other thing that makes the coffee house important is the architecture of the space. It was a space where people would get together from different backgrounds, different fields of expertise, and share. It was a space where ideas could have sex. This was their conjugal bed, in a sense. Ideas would get together there. And an astonishing number of innovations from this period have a coffee house somewhere in their story. I've been spending a lot of time thinking about coffee houses for the last 5 years because I've been on this quest to investigate this question of where good ideas come from. What are the environments that lead to unusual levels of innovation, unusual levels of creativity? What's the kind of environmental, the space of creativity? And what I've done is I've looked at both environments like the coffee house, I've looked at media environments like the World Wide Web that have been extraordinarily innovative. I've gone back to the history of the first cities. I've even gone to biological environments like coral reefs and rainforests that involve unusual levels of biological innovation. And what I've been looking for is, shared patterns, kind of signature behavior that shows up again and again in all of these environments? Are there recurring patterns that we can learn from that we can take and kind of apply to our own lives or our own organizations, our own environments to make them more creative and innovative? And I think I've found a few. But what you have to do to make sense of this and to really understand these principles is you have to do away with a lot of the way in which our conventional metaphors and language steers us towards certain concepts of idea creation. We have this very rich vocabulary to describe moments of inspiration, right? We have kind of the flash of insight, the stroke of insight. We have epiphanies. We have eureka moments. We have the light bulb moments. All of these concepts, as kind of rhetorically florid as they are, share this basic assumption, which is that an idea is a single thing. It's something that happens often in a wonderful, illuminating moment. But in fact, what I would argue and what you really need to kind of begin with is this idea that an idea is a network on the most elemental level. I mean, this is what is happening inside your brain. A new idea is a new network of neurons firing in sync with each other inside your brain. It's a new configuration that has never formed before. And the question is, how do you get your brain into environments where these new networks are going to be more likely to form? And it turns out that, in fact, the network patterns of the outside world mimic a lot of the network patterns of the internal world of the human brain. More often than not, our breakthrough ideas are cobbled together from whatever parts that happen to be around nearby. We take ideas from other people, from people we've learned from people we run into in the coffee shop, and we stitch them together into new forms and we create something new. That's really where innovation happens. When you research this field, people are notoriously unreliable when they actually self-report on where they have their own good ideas or their history of their best ideas. And a few years ago, a wonderful researcher named Kevin Dunbar decided to go around and basically do the Big Brother approach to figuring out where good ideas come from. He went to a bunch of science labs around the world and videotaped everyone as they were doing every little bit of their job. So when they were sitting in front of the microscope, when they were talking to their colleagues at the water cooler and all these things. And he recorded all these conversations and tried to figure out where the most important ideas happened. And when we think about the classic image of the scientist in the lab, we have this image, you know, they're pouring over the microscope and they see something, you know, in the tissue sample and, oh, eureka, they've got the idea. What happened actually when Dunbar looked at the tape is that, in fact, almost all the important breakthrough ideas did not happen alone in the lab in front of the microscope. They happened at the conference table at the weekly lab meeting when everybody got together and shared their latest data and findings. Oftentimes, when people shared the mistakes they were having, the error, the noise, and the signal they were discovering. And something about that environment, and I've started calling it the kind of the liquid network, where you have lots of different eyes, ideas that are together, different backgrounds, different interests, jostling with each other, bouncing off each other, that environment is, in fact, the environment that leads to innovation. The other problem that people have is they like to condense their stories of innovation down to shorter time frames. So they want to tell the story of the eureka moment. They want to say, there I was standing there, and I had it all suddenly clear in my head. But in fact, if you go back and look at the historical record, it turns out that a lot of important ideas have very long incubation periods. I call this the slow hunch. We've heard a lot recently about hunch and instinct and kind of blink-like sudden moments of clarity. But in fact, a lot of great ideas linger on, sometimes for decades, in the back of people's minds. They have a feeling that there's an interesting problem, but they don't quite have the tools yet to discover them. They spend all this time working on certain problems, but there's another thing lingering there that they're interested in, but they can't quite solve. Darwin is a great example of this. Darwin himself, in his autobiography, tells the story of coming up with the idea for natural selection as a classic eureka moment. He's in his study, it's October of 1838, and he's reading Malthus, actually, on population, and all of a sudden, the basic algorithm of natural selection kind of pops into his head, and he says, ah, at last, I had a theory with which to work. That's in his autobiography. About a decade or two ago, a wonderful scholar named Howard Gruber went back and looked at Darwin's notebooks from this period, and Darwin kept these copious notebooks where he wrote down every little idea he had, every little hunch, and what Gruber found was that Darwin had the full theory of natural selection for months and months and months before he had his alleged epiphany reading Malthus in October of 1838. There are passages where you can read it and you think like you're reading from a Darwin textbook from the period before he has this epiphany. So what you realize is that Darwin, in a sense, had the idea, he had the concept, but unable of fully thinking it yet. And that is actually how great ideas often happen. They fade into view over long periods of time. Now, the challenge for all of us is, How do you create environments that allow these ideas to have this long half-life, right? It's hard to go to your boss and say, I have an excellent idea for our organization. It will be useful in 2020. Could you just give me some time to do that? Now, a couple of companies like Google, they have innovation time off, 20% time, where in a sense, those are hunch cultivating mechanisms in an organization. But that's a key thing. And the other thing is to allow those hunches to connect with other people's hunches. That's what often happens. You have half of an idea, somebody else has the other half, and if you're in the right environment, they turn into something larger than the sum of their parts.
A couple of things Stephen Johnson, a science writer and speaker, that was from his TED speech, said in there resonated with me. One, that everyone got together and shared their mistakes. And I think that's key, that in innovation, and certainly on the path to genius, it's important to feel free to make mistakes, a process that isn't encouraged enough throughout our education, but it's something necessary if the hope is to reach the right answers. And also the idea that, yes, eureka moments come, but they come on the heels of a lot of groundwork from a large and often divergent variety of sources. You know, you don't have them in a vacuum. People say it suddenly occurred to them, but that's because they've been noodling with the problem or the idea or a comparative idea for a very long time. The education is there. You don't become a genius in limbo. A savant is something else. I would say as a simile, the savant is like a contortionist, where the genius is more of an acrobat. One is just the way you're wired and the other takes huge application. We're actually going to hear now from first a mathematical genius and subsequently a mathematical savant on this The Sharon Hour tonight on KX935, dedicated to the topic of genius. Manjuba Kab is the winner of the Field Medal, which is the highest global award you can win in mathematics, also known as the Maths Nobel, but even more impressive because it's only awarded every 4 years. What's extraordinary about this maths genius is that he really, for the most part, didn't enjoy maths growing up. Hated his maths classes as an adolescent, which is an interesting lesson for us all. Here you're going to hear how he overcame his antipathy in the classroom and learnt to not only love his topic, but to study it at Harvard, teach it at Princeton, and excel at it to the point of genius.
Your mother taught you maths. She was a mathematician herself,
yeah,
and still is, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
And used to, bored with other subjects, go into a room and chat with her about maths and stuff?
Yeah, I always liked mathematics since I was very small, maybe 2 or 3 years old. I loved doing little math puzzles and coming up with little math questions, and then I'd go and bother her and say, is this the answer? Can you tell me how to do it? And her answer always was, you should figure it out yourself and then come tell me.
Oh, God.
And so I used to enjoy just playing around with mathematics, and if I ever got stuck, my mother was there as a resource, and that was something very useful.
But obviously she did something, the way she taught you, the way she inspired you in maths, that created your interest in it. And you've often said that to some extent, while Indians may be good at maths, the teaching is a bit robotic. How should maths be taught? Because a lot of people say, oh God, maths, I can't stand it.
Right, well, I sympathize with the people who say that, because I myself really didn't like mathematics class. So I used to do anything I could to avoid going to mathematics class.
Really?
I would skip out by any excuse I could find. One thing I did was just take off several months from school and come to Jaipur here in India, where I didn't have to go to school. In fact, one time my parents and my grandparents put me in school here, but I dropped out after a couple of weeks.
I see.
I knew I loved mathematics, but I didn't like the way mathematics was taught in school. And so I used to find my own ways to make mathematics fun. I used to play around with mathematics, Do puzzles, ask my mom for nice suggestions that would be fun for me. My grandfather, who was a Sanskrit scholar, he had lots of mathematics textbooks on his shelf from ancient India. I used to read those. So I had a very non-standard mathematics education.
Wow.
And I really enjoyed it. And I think that contributed a lot to how
enjoying
I think about mathematics.
Enjoying it is the key, actually. Yeah.
So my suggestion for teaching math in schools is really about making mathematics fun. Because mathematics actually is fun. A lot of us don't realize that when we go to grade school mathematics classes, because it is taught in this robotic way. You're given a problem and you're asked to memorize steps to solve it, and then you just blindly apply it and try to be careful so you don't make an error, but you don't really know why you're doing these steps. It shouldn't be like that. It should be about being creative, coming up with those steps on your own. Everyone will come up with a different way to do it. Mathematics is great is that there's always one answer, but there are many ways to come to that answer.
Right, right.
And in school we're taught one way to come to that answer, and mathematics is about coming up with your own creative ways to come to that one right answer. There's not one path, and everybody has a personal path that they can discover, and that's what makes it fun. That's the adventurous part of mathematics, the creative part of mathematics. We miss that in the way mathematics is taught.
Are you saying this teaching of mathematics slightly robotic around the world and worse in India, or India's like the rest of the world, it's generally taught in a robotic way?
It's pretty bad throughout the world.
Throughout the world.
But in India, I hear it's even more about memorization than it is in other parts of the world. So maybe it goes even to a little further extent.
But it's fascinating that you hated maths class and that you used to just do it yourself. A bad lesson for all of you. Maybe it's a bloody good lesson, actually.
You know, I shouldn't say that about all my classes. There are many classes that I liked a lot, too, and I had some fantastic teachers, both in New York and in Jaipur when I went to school. And when I really liked the class, I would actually be encouraged. I would, like, want to sit in the front because I was so excited about the class. And when I was less excited about the class, I would prefer to hide. So it really depended on the quality of the teaching. And I think that's true of everyone. When you're excited, you want to go sit up front. When you're less excited but you have to go, you'll go and try to hide. A couple of math teachers that I had were actually really good. And those are years where I did go to every class and I was excited about it. And I would sit up closer. So one thing that I've been doing at Princeton University the past 3 years, I developed a course for freshmen, so first years, where we teach mathematics through poetry and classical music, classical Indian music, and then magic tricks and games. So those are the four ingredients of the course through which I get to teach fundamental mathematics concepts. So most classes begin with a card trick that's based on a mathematical concept. And when you see this card trick, there's nothing you can do but to want to know how that worked.
Right.
And for the card tricks that I do, or for the rope tricks, or the various other kinds of magic tricks that I do, there's a fundamental math concept that you have to learn in order to know how it works. And everyone is so immediately excited about knowing how did it work. And so while they learn how it works and while they learn how to do the magic trick, they can't avoid but also learn in the process that fundamental mathematics concept.
Right, right.
And when you learn it that way, you have that visual of the trick, that memory of the trick of how it worked. There's no way you'll forget the mathematics. So actually, I teach in 3-hour seminars. I start with the trick, and then I have everyone discuss, okay, what are the things that went into the trick? What are the things that could have been happening? And then, you know, I give little hints. And everyone has to think about it themselves, and then they have to sort of come up with their own way of understanding how it all went. And by the end of the class, they know how to do the trick, and they know the mathematics concept. And since they discovered it on their own, there's no way they'll ever forget it.
Right, exactly. And as you say, it's a visual come curiosity coming practical. You'll never forget that.
Exactly. And the same happens there with games. There are lots of fundamental games that have basic mathematics concepts embedded in them. If you know those math concepts, you can always win the game. And so I have people play this game with each other. And eventually some people start winning because they start seeing what math concept will allow them to win. And eventually everybody figures it out, and by the end of the class they can go and play their friends who are not in that class and beat them. And the reason is because they figured out that math concept on their own during this class.
That's why you're seen at Las Vegas all the time, right?
Actually, that's another common question I get when I've been giving lecture tours about this kind of way of teaching. Can this be used in Las Vegas? And the answer is yes, but I don't use it that way.
You're listening to Manju Bhakav, a mathematical genius who won the Fields Medal, which is the highest global award in mathematics. It's nicknamed the Maths Nobel. He's proof that you can emerge as a genius in something, even if you didn't think it was the something that was going to be your life. Although as a tot, the progeny of a mathematician, he did enjoy the subject and showed aptitude for it. Once he went to school, the excitement for maths was sort of knocked out of him because it was taught in a very pedestrian way. For genius to emerge, there has to be excitement about the topic, and that excitement came later in life, with Manju recognizing that maths is a creative art form more than a dry science. Genius is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935.
I wanted to ask you, when did you actually figure out that you were actually quite good at this? Not quite good, you were just outstanding. Which point did the turning point happen?
I don't know if I ever even thought in those terms.
Really?
I knew I liked it, and so I would do mathematics whenever I had the chance to. I went to a school that didn't really have that much math enrichment. It wasn't one of the top subjects of the public school that I went to. So I didn't really think in those terms. I avoided math class, as I said, and I would do math on my own. And I did well on all the exams. You know, I always got a perfect score on all the exams, but I didn't know if that meant anything in particular. But when I really got excited about math and realized that that's what I definitely want to do for a living, was when I got to college at Harvard. That was the first time when I met lots of students who liked mathematics. Before, it was just me. So that was a real eye-opening experience for me, and I was at Harvard doing mathematics with all the other students who are at Harvard, and I thought, I thought maybe this is something I should do, because I can do it at the same level as the people here. Mathematics should be thought of as an art. Sometimes we don't see that when we do mathematics in grade school, but just like any art, like music, like painting, mathematics is a creative subject. Coming up with the theorems is an art. Finding the way to understand why that theorem is true is an art. Everyone comes up with a different answer to the same questions. And the reason is that there are different ways of understanding things, different ways of expressing yourself, just like in any art. And one reason I teach my course through poetry, through magic, through music, through games, is these are all different kinds of art. And mathematics closely connects to all of them. It really should be taught that way, in my opinion. Mathematics is often taught as a science, but a lot of people don't know that it has a lot of its origins, especially in India, in the arts. And we shouldn't forget that artistic aspect. We should be using both sides of the brain to understand mathematics problems.
In fact, you said there's some mathematical basis to music as well. Tabla, for example.
Yeah, definitely.
So what is the connection?
Well, in tabla is all about rhythms, time cycles, trying to fit various pieces into a rhythm cycle. And so the arrangements that one practices as a tabla player uses a lot of mathematics. One example that I always start with in the class that I teach, just to get people to realize that mathematics is connected with poetry and with music, is an example of Hemachandra, because it brings in tabla and poetry and mathematics right away. So in Sanskrit poetry, there are two kinds of syllables. There's the notion of a laghu syllable and a guru syllable. Exactly. The notion of laghu and guru is something that led to some of the most fundamental breakthroughs in mathematics, believe it or not, in ancient times in India. There's a notion of laghu syllable and a guru syllable, a short syllable and a long syllable. So in every kind of poetry in the world, there's a notion of stressed syllable and unstressed syllable. When you say poetry, some syllables are stressed, some are unstressed. In Sanskrit, that goes a step further. The stressed syllables are long, the unstressed syllables are short. And the short syllables take one beat of time to say, a long syllable takes two beats of time to say. So what's peculiar about Sanskrit is that a long syllable takes exactly twice as long to say as a short syllable. Oh. So when you recite Sanskrit poetry, all the syllables will be like this. Some will last one beat of time, some will last two beats of time. The short are one beat, the longer are two beats. And so this is very peculiar about Sanskrit. And as a result of the setup of Sanskrit poetry, lots of ancient poets considered lots of mathematical questions that related to this one beat, two beat setup of Sanskrit poetry. So one basic question that would come up, if you're writing poetry and you have eight beats left in your stanza, and you need to fill it with long and short syllables, where a long syllable takes two beats, and a short syllable takes one beat. How many ways can you fill in eight beats with long syllables and short syllables, where a long syllable is two beats?
Don't give us the answer. Anybody know?
What would be your guess?
Oh, wow, come on.
By permutations and combinations?
It is about permutations and combinations, but it's sort of beyond what we learn in school. What would be a guess? So eight beats, filling it with longs and shorts. Long, two beats, short.
Four short beats.
No,
and
how
two
many
long beats.
How many variations
yeah,
can you have?
How many ways could
two
you do
ways.
It? Yeah. So you could do long, 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 long.
That's right, four long,
do
it. Yes.
You could do short, 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 short,
eight
short,
times,
short,
yeah.
short, short. Or you
and
could do
you can
short, short, long, short, long, 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 short, short, long. Right? You could do So I actually do these, I clap these rhythms with my class and we
right.
go through and
yeah,
we try
yeah.
to figure out how many there are. The answer is 34. So this
you just went straight above my head.
Most people, when they first hear this question, they would think, oh, maybe there are 8 ways, 10 ways.
Right.
The answer is actually 34, which is more than most people expect.
Most people would have thought, yeah.
And in this ancient Indian work of Hemachandra, which I read to the class because it's written in poetry, the answer. So it's a poetic question. It's a question about poetry, and the answer is written in poetry. It's something that really excites people. It excited
right.
me when I was a child,
yeah,
so I like to share it, and it really excites students. And so Hemachandra's answer was as follows. He says, write down the numbers 1 and 2, and then every number you write down subsequently should be the sum of the previous two numbers that you wrote down. So 1, 2, and then 1 plus 2 is 3, then 2 plus 3 is 5,
right.
3 plus 5 is 8, 5 right. plus 8 is 13, 8 plus 13 is 21, 13 plus 21 is 34, and so on. The eighth number that you write down will give you the number of rhythms that have 8 beats, which was 34.
Wow, that's amazing actually.
And this goes back to the year 1050. So these numbers may be familiar to many people, right? They're called the Fibonacci numbers in India, even though in India they were discovered pre-Fibonacci by Hemachandra in this work on poetry, which I find really amazing. So when we're taught Fibonacci numbers in school, you need to know the answer if you want to know how many ways you can fill in the rest of your poem if you have a certain number of beats left.
You're tuned to The Sharer Now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935, talking about genius tonight. I imagine it's not always much fun to be a genius, even though we all aspire to be geniuses. Certainly it'd be lovely to be right about everything all the time and to be super knowledgeable, but it probably wouldn't do you much good in this world in terms of social acceptability, being loved, being able to love. People who are geniuses tend to live more in their heads. They've got so much going on there that action is either superfluous or just an unnecessary distraction for them from where they want to be. That makes relationships difficult. And in fact, a lot of geniuses, certainly savants, are considered to be on the spectrum. They're so consumed by all the information going through their heads and ideas related to the topic that they're a genius at, that they don't really have much time for external communication with people. I'm going to play you now a bit from a genius savant who appeared on the David Letterman show. He's an English mathematical genius. His name is Daniel Tammet, and apart from anything else, he can recite the entire equation of pi. You know, we know pi as 3.14. He knows it as 3.141592 ongoing, and he knows other things too. Certainly a lot more than David Letterman can even comprehend.
How would one describe you?
I'm a savant. There are different types of savant. I'm a prodigious savant. It means somebody with exceptional mental abilities, exceptional even in perhaps people without any problems. I mean, I had epilepsy as a small child, and we believe that maybe the seizures kick something in the brain.
So without this seizure, you might not have had these abilities. Is that what
sure.
you're saying?
I yes. see.
And this is a good thing for you to be a savant, is that correct?
Yes. I mean,
does it have any drawbacks?
It has lots of drawbacks.
Well, what would be some of the drawbacks, some of the minuses for this?
Well, I was recently diagnosed with Asperger's as well, which is a high-functioning form of autism. So what scientists who have studied me believe is that it's the epilepsy and the autism combined which has caused these abilities that I have.
Well, that's interesting that the two negative occurrences have actually produced this rarefied positive.
Absolutely. Yes.
What are the symptoms that manifest themselves for Asperger's?
In terms of Asperger's, it's inability to socialize very easily, a really strong and narrow interest in particular areas. Mm-hmm. I've always loved numbers, and I've always loved words and language as well, and these are the two areas where I seem to have real ability to flourish and do well.
But at the expense of social interaction?
Yes. I mean, it's getting
better.
But
you seem like you're doing just fine sitting here talking to me.
Thank you. That's very kind of you to say. It's taken a long time. I'm 26 now, and I had the seizures when I was, I think, 4. So
and it did not recur? Just the one episode?
There were several seizures. I mean, the first was very severe. I almost died.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
But as you grew older, you seemed to grow out of them. Is that more or less how you would characterize
it? Yes, that's right.
All right, so let's dwell now on what this has left you with. What can you do that everybody else can't do?
Okay, well, last year on March 14th, which is Pi Day in America.
Pi Day?
Yes, Pi
Ooh,
Day.
I love pie.
I love pie too. But it's not your type of pie. Oh. It's a mathematical number. So on Pi Day, well, Pi Day is 314, and those are the first numbers in the number pi.
That's
3.14.
Right. Yes, third month and
14th day, yeah. So I recited pi, which is an irrational number, which means you can't express it as a fraction. It goes on forever and ever. I recited it from memory to over 22,500 places, and it took me 5 hours, and we had lots of invigilators to check that I made no mistakes, and it only took me a few weeks to learn number. And it was really good because we raised lots of money for epilepsy charities in the UK, and I really did show that being a savant and having these advantages and disadvantages shouldn't hold you back.
Now, go back to the recitation of pi. It took you, you say, 5 hours to recite?
Yeah. So I recited pi to 22,514 decimal places. It took me 5 hours and 9 minutes. And the hardest part of it was actually the physical side, because it was like running a marathon in your head, if you can imagine that. It's a just constant flow of numbers. And I had some water and I had some bananas and chocolate to keep my energy level.
And another person, not being a savant, could they have not committed this to memory?
Yes, they can.
They could have,
and people have done that, but it's taken them years, and usually they have to have several attempts because it's a big thing to do. Right. And
do you still remember it now, even
yes,
though this happened a month
yes,
ago?
Yes, yes. Wow. I mean, that's the other thing. When I'm learning numbers, see, what I'm doing is I'm visualizing numbers. When you look at a number, when you look at, say, 43, you just see the number 4 and 3,
right,
like most people do. But when I'm looking at a different numbers, you know, whatever number it is, I'm seeing colours and shapes and textures. It's something called synesthesia, because my brain is working in such a way that I'm looking and also experiencing colour. So it's two senses combined. So I haven't seen this show before, I have to say.
You've never
coming
seen
from
show?
London, no. Yeah. And I'm sitting with you now and I'm watching you and I'm seeing you and you're a very handsome man, I have to say.
But, let me just say, you got my number.
I have to say, you know, you look like the number 117.
117?
You look like 117.
Thank you very much.
117, it's a handsome number. It's tall, it's a lanky number. A little bit wobbly.
A little bit wobbly.
Yeah.
What's the thing about birthdays? Is this like a party trick, or is this something that demonstrates your savant-ism or power or whatever? Okay, my birthday is... guess my birthday. Is that how it works?
Sure.
I tell you what my birthday
tell
is.
Tell me what your birthday is.
April 12th,
yeah.
1947. April 12th, 1947.
Okay. Okay, so you were born on a Saturday... And do you know?
I don't know.
You don't know? Okay. And you turn 65 in 2012. That will be on a Thursday.
Actually, I double-checked. I keep all my old diaries in little piles. And it was a Thursday, or a Thursday, as he said. You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935. And my topic tonight is genius. And as you've heard throughout the show, genius may not quite belong to you. You might just be the receptacle for genius, or a genie of a particular kind. So it may be something you're not allowed to be too proud of. It was delivered to you, perhaps not earned. It can be as much a curse as a benefit. Certainly if accompanied with autism or Asperger's, which in the case of a savant, it very often is, and seizures. It obviously requires the brain to work in a super mode, at least in the kind of ways the average, let's say, brain doesn't. You're one of a very small number of people. You have very few peers to share your particular area of advanced knowledge with. So it isn't necessarily an invaluable asset. I mean, how many times are you going to have the chance to impress people with reciting to the 22,000th of pi? Nobody's going to sit there for hours and listen. It's not terribly exciting to anyone. At least if you're a Mozart or a Tchaikovsky, you're introducing something special into the world that others can enjoy in various forms or incarnations for eras to come.
Hydrangea, gold cash divine, cashmere cologne, and white sunshine, red racing cars, sunset and vine, the kids were young and pretty. Where have you been? Where did you go? Those summer nights seem long ago. And so is the girl you used to call the Queen of New York City. But if you send for me, you know I'll come. And if you call for me, you know I'll run. I'll run to you, I'll run to you, I'll run, run, run. I'll come to you, I'll come to you, I'll come. Sunsets, small town, I'm out of time. Will you still love me when I shine? from words but not from beauty. My father's love was always strong. My mother's glamour lives on and on. Yet still inside I felt alone, for reasons unknown to me.
A variation, that, of course, of Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet, that song by Lana Del Rey. You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935. My topic tonight is genius, and I've been playing you an interview David Letterman did with a savant called Daniel Tennant. He can recite from memory a 2,000-plus figure equation for pi, where most of us can barely remember the three-figure one, 3.14. It was something he learned in a few weeks. It took him almost that long to recite the 2,000-odd figures. No, seriously, it took him over 5 hours. Luckily, he has more intriguing talents for the layman, because Letterman quite reasonably wondered how that served him in the world.
Are you able to make some money with what you do? I mean, I'm not being silly about it, but are you? This is a rarefied, is a gift, isn't it?
Sure.
It's rarefied. Only a handful of people do this.
Yeah, I mean, there are something like 25 savants in the world,
and people are studying you. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. There are scientists in America, in California, and also in places like Oxford and Cambridge in the UK, yeah, who are studying me, because what they're looking for is to see whether or not anyone, you know, can do this, yeah, whether or not it's learn numbers easier, speak another language.
What's your birthday?
My birthday is January 31st, 1979. You got a 1 in 7 shot.
Wednesday.
It was a Wednesday.
Good guess. So we're nearing the end of tonight's Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935. The topic tonight was genius. I think we're all in awe of genius, but do we really want it for ourselves or for those around us? It can be tough being a genius. You know, I think we've learnt that happiness lies somewhere in the middle of things. They did a survey, actually, of the happiest cities in Southern California, and Laguna Beach actually didn't feature. Number 2 was Irvine. Number 6 was Huntington Beach. Both in the main middle-ish kind of areas, in terms at least of socioeconomics, I would say. And speaking for myself, I have friends and acquaintances at all ends of a variety of spectrums, and I have found that I'm probably most comfortable with people in the middle of this or that. So if happiness is what you're after, you may want to relish being average. And if the pursuit of excellence is what you're after, which represents a more productive life, don't worry about overexceeding yourself necessarily. I think even if we try our very hardest, which is a noble pursuit, most of us will probably only ever reach the heights of mediocrity, and that's not a terrible thing. On that note, if you don't live in Laguna Beach and or you want to hear the show again, it does also podcast on iTunes, or go to kx935.com, where we have a lot of upcoming events that will interest you. For the podcast of this particular show, the link is kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, a pun on my name, hour with the H. And if you do live in Laguna Beach and want to listen live, the Sharon Hour airs on Monday nights at 9. This is Sharon James saying thank you for listening. Have a great week, and hopefully you'll tap into your inner genius, or at least your very best mediocre self.